text says the word of the Lord was rare in those days. Visions were not widespread. Not all that different from our time. When was the last time our nation had a prophet speak to us, for example? Somebody that we all as a nation listened to. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. comes to my mind, but that was over 50 years ago. History, like our story here concerning Samuel and Eli. As our story begins, Samuel, a 12-year-old temple assistant, is ministering to the Lord under Eli, the high priest. And Barbara Brown Taylor, who is one of my favorite preachers, does a good job of describing what Samuel's life was like in the temple from her vantage point, at least. She says, we can only guess, really, what the life was like for young Samuel as a faithful brought in their burnt offerings and their sin offerings and their guilt offerings to the temple. They were burdened people, people who were under the law, who had to fulfill obligations, many of them whom couldn't afford to do so, most of them hauling their stubborn animals up to the altar to be slaughtered. Like a modern-day slaughterhouse, there was a great deal of blood, blood that was splattered all over the altar, blood that was sprinkled all over the veil that separated the Holy of the Holies from the rest of the sanctuary. There was burning incense, too, in the temple, lots of it. And it was there to do battle with the sickeningly sweet smell that blood gives off when it's been spilled. But it didn't stand a chance against this onslaught of slaughter. The place smelled of death. And maybe Samuel tended the cauldron where the sacrificial meat was being boiled following the slaughter of the animals, or maybe he helped Eli locate the portion that he was allowed to eat as the temple priest and cut off a section for himself later to feed on the scraps. Who knows how he went about his daily activities in the temple. At night, though, we know he lay down by the Ark of God, the legendary throne of the invisible King Yahweh that Israel had carried with her over 1,000 years into battle ahead of her armies, Lord of the Hosts. It was reputed to contain all of the sacred relics of their nation's past, much the way Washington, D.C. houses our sacred relics of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. It was reported to have contained in the Ark a container of manna all the way back from the days with Moses in the wilderness. It was purported to have contained Aaron's rod and staff that he had used. The tablets of the covenant, too, that Moses received on Mount Sinai were inside this covenant. And sleeping next to it had to be like sleeping in the Museum of Natural History by yourself. You know, it was huge, this temple, like St. John the Divine. Not, in other words, a day or a boyhood spent in the park, not frolicking and having fun, but a boyhood spent in close proximity to all that was considered sacred, very sacred in his day, and it must have been a serious obligation to be the assistant to the head priest. It must have been like it was today, serving the Pope in the Vatican as his assistant, a boyhood spent in the very household of God, growing up next to God, so to speak, having grown up as a pastor's son, always in and around the church my whole life. I can't help but relate to this story just a tiny bit because of Samuel's life, always in and around the church, whether it was in my father's churches or in my grandfather's church or in my uncle's churches. It was part of my DNA. How could I have chosen anything else, almost? And over the years of apprenticeship, Samuel would have enjoyed an insider's view of religious life. It would have been just like breathing the air for him. The language of faith would have been his first language, not his second. Words of grace and judgment, law and order would have been common to him. It would roll off the tip of his tongue. The language he spoke most fluently was the Lord's. He would have handled holy objects every day. He would have been listening to the whispered prayers as people brought up their animals. He would have witnessed conversions, people having transformational experience. Granted, he would have also seen all of the contradictions that go into the institutional temple or the institutional church, all of the intrigues, the scandals too, I'm sure. But his circumstances would have primed him to know God on a firsthand basis, wouldn't you think? Or so we'd like to assume. What the story reveals, however, is a surprise. Samuel did not yet know the Lord. and the word of the Lord had not yet been revealed to him. Samuel, Samuel, thinking it was Eli. The easy interpretation of this text is to say that there's a big difference between knowing about God and knowing God, which is true. But it really doesn't lead us anywhere else after that statement. But I think that the writer of 1 Samuel is saying something to us about the spiritual risks that are inherent in becoming too insulated because of our knowledge of faith, because of the churchiness, so to speak, that we grow up in. Something about a shadow side of the human institution, even the most well-meaning and well-run religious institutions sometimes have a dark side. Something about the necessary role of the outsider as prophet. It's why we have Amos and Hosea and Malachi and all of these other prophets that weren't part of the temple establishment critiquing their religion and their society of the time. When I think about my own God-saturated upbringing, I am filled with gratitude for what it has given me. I'm filled for the hope that it gives me, for the story to live out my life of, for the hope of a resurrection to a new life. I'm so glad that I've had the privilege to grow up in the church, to be shaped from my earliest memories by its rituals and its rhythms. Christmas wasn't just about toys. It was also about decorating the house with angels and the shepherds and Jesus and Mary and Joseph. It was about telling the story out of Matthew and Luke's Gospels on Christmas morning to one another. It was about going through that reminder of what it all meant, and Easter the same way, building towards it. So these rhythms gave shape and meaning to my life. I thought about them not so much as secular people might think about, you know, summer coming on, but now this is ordinary time coming on, or this is Advent coming on, or this is Lent coming on. That's how my life revolved, it seemed. But Samuel's story gives me a bit of pause because it raises a possibility that my familiarity with the institution has made it harder for me to hear something that's new or something that's unexpected from God. And it raises the question for all of us who love the church, are active in the church, to wonder if it also at times dulls our ears to God's call today because we know it so well. If so, I take comfort in the fact that God did not give up on Samuel. He called and called and called again. Three times God reached out to Samuel. He did not give up on Samuel until Samuel had learned to listen. God kept coming to him until he learned to listen. According to the religious hierarchies of the day, the people who should have heard God's voice coming to them were Eli, the temple priest, the high priest, and his sons, who were scheduled to inherit that role upon his death. But God had different ideas. The authorities, you see, they were the ultimate insiders by birth. They were Levites, and by vocation, they were called to this wonderful task, this serious task, this almighty task. But they were not the ones that God chose to continue in that role. He continued with a little boy who had been serving these adults. Instead, he chose a child, a boy on the periphery, one whose capacity for openness and wonder was still recoverable. He still experienced the awe that so many children experience of life. A child who wasn't bound by the political interests of his elders, by the intrigue of the temple. A child who could tolerate an uncomfortable message, a message that would upend the very institution that he knew and loved and had served his whole life. He was now going to be called to now challenge that institution. Strange that God should choose an unexpected, untested spokesperson, an untested preacher with no prophetic credentials to his name. For young Samuel, his place in history would not be by his choice, but would be by God's determined destiny for him. This week, we remembered the birth of Dr. Martin Luther King, and more importantly, we remembered his life and what that life stood for, and how tragically it was cut short, just like Jesus's life was tragically cut short. And we remember that prophetic ministry of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and we see a very similar situation to the one that Samuel encountered. A young man, inexperienced in matters of public leadership, coming right out of Boston University, with his theological diploma still wet with ink from having it been signed by the president, and yet called upon immediately to give direction to a march for freedom, the likes of which only Moses, and only Gandhi have ever known. They transformed entire nations without violence. That's remarkable. Sadly, the world no longer seeks the moral guidance of the church. Not really. It appears the church itself is in need of guidance today. The world has set aside the moral authority of the church, probably for good reason too. Because we who have been commissioned to speak on behalf of God have chosen either to be silent in the face of everything that God has called us to critique, or we have been asleep. What does it mean when the Pope of the Roman Catholic Church dares to accuse the entire church of impotent silence, suggesting the church and its leaders suffer not only from a lust for power? As Jesus said, they like to be seen in nice robes in the marketplace. They like to be seen amongst their colleagues. But for what calls for what he says, what the Pope says, calls our church universal, suffers with spiritual Alzheimer's. These are his words, which essentially means that the church has forgotten what it was here to do in the first place. If it's not representing God and God's audaciously radical plan to upend the powers that be in our society, then the church is not doing what God calls it to do. These are serious times that we live in, folks, as serious as Montgomery, as serious as Selma. The economics of our country look something similar to at the turn of the century when the Rockefellers and the Carnegies dominated the world's landscape. They are serious times that we live in. Someone's got to awaken Samuel today. Somebody's got to wake up our next prophet. It is good and right that we should celebrate the life and the commitment of Dr. Martin Luther King with a national holiday. He is the one Christian person in our country that we have so honored a preacher this way. But hopefully we are learning the inescapable lesson that the battle is not over. That while we celebrate those achievements of the 64 Voting Rights Act and the way forward for Black America in this country, we are learning the inescapable lesson today that the battle has not yet been won and will never be completely won. The struggle continues today as it has always continued. It's never free freedom. The struggle for freedom and opportunity still is our struggle, just as it was our parents' struggle and our grandparents' struggle and our ancestors' struggle. It's a never-ending struggle. And while moments and monuments are important to honor our ancestors and they are good, they are not good enough. Who will speak to us in our time and place? Who is it that's going to address us and awaken the conscience of a country again? Who is it that is prepared to fill Samuel's shoes or Dr. Martin Luther King's shoes? I think in many ways we are like sheep without a shepherd today. So who is God calling, the text raises? What about you? What about me? What about us? What if we become that voice today? Amen.
I want to thank you, Lord.